Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians. The companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, doctors, investors, journalists, the list goes on, that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners will know, I am a CEO and co-founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc and our Healthy Heart Check are now the number one diagnostic product on the high street, available in Boots, Superdrug and other retailers. Our Healthy Heart Check allows you to do in 9 minutes the equivalent of the NHS Health Check. So if you're interested, go check it out with one of those retailers or go to our website, which is pocdoc.co, P-O-C-D-O-C.co. We also work extensively with the NHS across the country. And if you're lucky enough to be in one of those areas, you may well be able to get a Healthy Heart Check for free at the point of care. So if you're interested, like I said, pocdoc.co. And thank you very much to everybody at PocDoc for supporting the show on an ongoing basis. Thank you also, as I say every week, thank you to the awesome team at UK Health Radio. Johan and his team put on an incredible station with lots of really interesting presenters and really interesting content, not just this show, obviously. So if you do have an extra moment, check out everything else that's going on. And you can also find all of the shows from UK Health Radio on the podcast channels. Then I'd like to also, as ever, thank everyone that's listening to this on demand through your podcast channel of choice. We're now getting downloads in countries, in over 50 countries a month, which every week I say still blows me away. It's incredible. And thank you if you're watching this on YouTube or on my Instagram channel, which is at Steve Roost, which is where we take some of the best bits from each show and we put the clips out. Some of the stuff that's blowing up at the moment, some of the clips from our show with Dr. Amar Ahmed, who's one of the UK's leading GPs and kind of technologists, is really blowing up. There's some pretty spicy comments going on there around some of his, what he's been talking about GPs and the reality for GPs. So that seems like it's stimulated quite a lot of debate. So check that out if you can. So today I'm actually broadcasting live from the Tony Blair Institute. For those of you that don't know, I think probably a lot of people listening know who Tony Blair is. That wasn't what I was going to say. But the Institute has become one of the leading global voices in disease prevention, particularly around things like cardiovascular disease, which is very close to my heart and obviously what we focus on at PocDoc. So it's an honor to be broadcasting live from the Institute. What a cool thing to be able to say. The last show that we did was with Richard Harrison, who is the healthcare services manager at Asda, and he's a community pharmacy veteran. I love community pharmacy. It's where we started with PocDoc. We owe community pharmacy a huge amount. So if that's your bag, go check that show out because it was really, really interesting. But on to today's show. Now, what we've always been really lucky with on the Health Tech Hour, obviously my producer, Arthur, is phenomenal, but a lot of the time, I got to admit, we're quite lucky. We get lucky with timing. So on today's show, we have, I would say, probably the absolute perfect guest for the period of time that we find ourselves in right now, as far as the NHS is concerned. So anyone in the NHS or working with the NHS or connected to the NHS is very, very interested in what's about to be published, which is the 10-year plan. Now, there's probably a lot of people listening that are like the what now, which I totally understand. But if you're in and around healthcare, you know what the 10-year plan is. There's a lot that we don't know. In effect, the 10-year plan is the government's vision for what the NHS will look like over the next 10 years. So everything that you think about with the NHS, that you worry about with the NHS, from GPs to surgery to whatever else it is, mental health, children's services, everything, this is the vision document about what the healthcare service looks like for the next 10 years. There's a lot we don't know. In fact, we don't know anything really. But one thing we do know for sure is that innovation is at the heart of everything to do with the future of the NHS. So whether that's prevention, prediction, AI doctors, AI scribes, genomics, whatever it happens to be, it all crosses over into this area of innovation. And my guest today is in effect the tip of the spear when it comes to innovation in the NHS and working with, on the other side of the table, innovators in the UK and internationally to help translate the NHS needs into the private sector. So on today's show, we have Richard Stubbs, who is the CEO of the Health Innovation Network, York and Humber, and the chair of the National Health Innovation Network. I won't read out Richard's full bio, but it's unbelievably impressive. So if you want to follow him on LinkedIn or wherever, it's an incredible, incredible story, which we'll get into. But Richard consistently ranks in the top 50 BAME NHS leaders. Although I was actually in an NHS meeting the other day where we were told not to say BAME, but that was in your profile. So I'm okay with saying it because you said that I could say it. And so on a personal note, Richard's one of my favorite people that we get to work with and get to talk to. So it's a real honor having him on the show. Don't worry when you're like, oh my God, what does the Health Innovation Network mean? I don't understand. We will explain that. But Richard, welcome to the show. How are you?
Steve, thank you so much for an intro. I'm very well, thank you. Delighted to be here.
We do well on this show, and intros, we do well on this show.
Excellent. Well, 2 out of 2.
So let's get started. Because we are a broad church, what is the Health Innovation Network? And I don't mean this to sound as brutal as is going to come across, but why should the listeners, the person on the street, care about it? What's the so what about the Health Innovation Network?
Okay. And by person on the street, we can we'll talk about why should an innovator care? Why should the taxpayer care?
Why should
Why should
everyone?
patients care? I mean, the different answers. I mean, simply put, let's start with, who are we? What do we do? Health Innovation Networks, we're the artists, formerly known as the Academic Health Science Networks or the HSNs. You may, if you've been around the health space for the last 10 years, have heard of the HSNs. And in effect, about 18 months ago now, we branded to Health Innovation Network, or HINs, as we are not allowed to call it, but ultimately we do, because everybody else does. It's just, we have to have an acronym, don't we, in the
I can neither confirm nor deny that we say hin.
Yeah, me too, me too. But at least we don't say HSN anymore. We're not allowed to say
No,
that. But,
no.
as I said, we've been around actually for quite a long time now, which is an interesting story in itself, in the sense that, the NHS constantly reinvents its infrastructure. We're constantly in a period of change. I'm sure we'll talk about that. And actually, whether we're called HSNs or HINs, we feel like we're now part of the, permanent infrastructure, because there's a big job to do. And that job is about the innovation adoption challenge. So although, the UK has a really rich R&D infrastructure, the government invests an awful lot through, various bodies, Innovate UK, UKRI, the National Institute for Health Research, and many, many others, as well as the private sector. We exist because, despite all that great work, the NHS is really slow at the uptake of innovation, and it needs our help. And that all came about as a result of a really important policy called Innovation, Health and Wealth, which was November 2011, which feels like a very long time ago now.
Wow,
But if you do happen to see an archived copy of Innovation, Health and Wealth, it's still worth a read, because a lot of the challenges it frames in terms of why aren't we great at this in the NHS are still relevant today. And HSNs before us, and now the HINs, we were created to fix that problem. So the day job, you talked about translation in your opener, Steve. The day job is absolutely, stepping into that space, with our NHS colleagues, but also with our industry colleagues and our academic colleagues, and saying, how do we practically make good stuff happen faster? And that's pretty much what it says on the badge.
And how does that improve the situation, either tangibly or intangibly, directly or indirectly, for patients,
Yeah.
basically?
And I think one of the things that you need to understand, I think, to understand, so what, so what's the benefit, is that, I mean, it's a cliche, isn't it? But there's no such thing as the NHS. And from a patient point of view, from a citizen's point of view, I think if you're outside of that, it seems like a really bizarre thing to say. But actually, This isn't a single organization. The NHS exists as an ecosystem, various different ways to describe it. But what it isn't is some kind of hierarchical corporate service where good innovation can cascade from the top in a seamless way. However, we need to make sure it does, because actually something that's invented in Devon and is fantastic for patients needs to also be fantastic for patients in Newcastle. Mm-hmm. And so we need to fix that problem. And that's why people should care that we exist. One of the things that we're trying to avoid here is the constant reinvention of good practice. The NHS is great at the invention piece. It's great at creation. Clinicians, by their very nature, are hugely curious, hugely smart people who will see a problem, own it, and go after trying to create their own solutions. What we're not great about is saying, hang on a minute, wait, let's look down the road. Maybe there's something that already works. Maybe UK's taxpayers have already invested in something which is fit for purpose. We can import it here, and actually it's going to do the job for us. Let's have that conversation first before we kind of go and do the reinvention piece. And that's one of the problems we're trying to solve, because it's inaffordable. We can't reinvent the wheel 400 times a year. We've got to think about, actually, great practice happens everywhere. Let's get that culture of spread happening. It's better for patients, but it's also better for clinicians, and also it's better for the taxpayer.
And when the AHSNs were created, my perception, the story I like to kind of to fall back on is sort of like, if you think about, I don't know, if you were building an HR SaaS business to sell into Amazon or something, if you were building an HR SaaS solution to sell into employers of over 5,000 people, there isn't an independent body that's created to help you do that, So actually, the fact that at some point some group of people got together within the NHS or the central government and said, no, we really should create this entire network of institutions, I think is actually one of the most forward-thinking things I can remember in the NHS. I mean, I think that was quite a big decision, right?
No, huge decision. I think you're right, really forward-thinking. I think one of the things that was really forward-thinking about it, and I think ultimately when you look at some of the great things that have happened in the NHS, you don't have to go far to see fingerprints on it. People like Lord Darcy, Ara Darcy, absolutely there at the start, at the birth of these things. Some really, really good NHS leaders like David Nicholson and others. But it was really forward-thinking. And it was forward-thinking to allow the HSNs or the HINs now to be either part of the NHS or not part of the NHS. And that's quite an interesting place that we inhabit, as you say. We're not quite independent, I would say. We're commissioned by the NHS to deliver for the NHS. But there's something about the fact that, if you think about my job as Chief Executive of Health Innovation in Yorkshire and Humber, my organisation is a not-for-profit company limited by guarantee. It's effectively an SME. And that gives me huge empathy for the world of innovators and SMEs. I have the same issues with NHS England in terms of late payments, no payments, looking at the cash flow, you're thinking about the leaks coming through the roof and how you're going to fix them. You're thinking about, do I need to lay people off this month because I can't actually guarantee to my board that we're a going concern.
Yeah.
These are all things that we face. And I think that's annoyingly quite helpful.
Yeah.
Rather than maybe part of the more bureaucratic machinery that the NHS can sometimes fall into.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's the way that the health innovation networks operate has over time, I think, become more innovator friendly, because as I don't know whether it's a personnel issue or a cultural thing or deliberate or just completely sort of organically. But I think on that point, there has been I've noticed more of an understanding about what it's like to be an SME innovator, which is effectively what PocDoc is and thousands of other companies in the UK.
But we've learned a lot, haven't we, as well? So I think there's so many reasons. I mean, it's nice to hear you say that. And there's so many reasons why I might think about why is that so. We've undoubtedly learned an awful lot. I mean, I wasn't quite here for the start of the HSN journey. I'm not quite a lifer, but I was not too far away. I was Deputy Director of Innovation for NHS England when we created them. So I was kind of on the other side of the fence. And I was 12 months later, I was in one, Yorkshire and Humber, feeling incredibly tribal, thinking I've got to go to mine. I can't, why would you go anywhere else? But in that time, you know, just thinking back, you know, even in my kind of 10, 11 years of being in and around them, there's an awful lot we've learned. There's an awful lot of mistakes that we've made. You know, that's a good thing. You know, as innovation agencies, we should be risk takers. We should try things out. You know, the crucial thing is, do you learn from it? Do you evaluate? Do you move on? So there's something about, we're just getting better at this and faster at this. Then I think there's also something crucial, which is, you know, if you think about, not that we're entirely staffed by NHS leaders and staff, but I'd guess that the majority of people working at HIN probably just about are people with NHS backgrounds. These are risky jobs to come and take. You know, if you think about the usual career path of an NHS person, you know, particularly if you're a clinician, but not exclusively, to say, actually, why don't you jump out of this career path and jump into one of these new organizations that's trying to do something radical just outside on the border? And for some of us, you know, that's also a leave your NHS terms and conditions behind, you know, you're going to work for a private company. So you're asking people to take massive, massive risk on a personal level within a culture or within an environment that doesn't necessarily always have a sustainability in terms of its innovation ecosystem. You know, so we can think about, you know, the Modernization Agency, we can think about the NHS Institute for Innovation and Improvement, we can think about NHS IQ, which I'm really sorry, but I can't even remember what that stood for.
Oh yeah, I remember that. When was that? What was that?
That was, I think that was there between about 1:15 PM and about 4:15 one summer in 2010. I think, and I honestly think I was employed by it at some point. I'll go and check my badges. But you know, the point is, these things churn.
Yeah.
And when ages end for creators, I mean, who would have looked at them and thought they're going to be here in 3 years, let alone 13 years? And I think that's testament to, you know, the fact that we are quite nimble. It's probably also a testament to the fact that our budget's not huge, so it's not a massive line to go recover. But actually, it's also, I think, now about the fact that it gives us the ability to attract really good staff, because I hope we're less of a risk.
Yeah, I also think there's been, I don't quite know, I guess, I think this is probably organic, but I feel like the ecosystem in the UK, and it's an interesting one. Let's talk about this, because the Health Innovation Network concept applies to England only, yes, or is it England only?
England only, although there are like-minded bodies in the devolved administrations.
Okay, doing something roughly similar.
Yeah, something. Okay. Yeah. And we're close to them, but yeah.
Okay. Because that's quite, and the 10-year plan separately, is that just for England and Wales, or is that also Scotland, or what is that?
Now you're putting me to the test. I believe it's for England and Wales, but you know, we're going to have
to. Okay, well, I know, I'm just curious.
Page one of the report next week.
Just curious. Yeah, no, I can't wait. So so the question I was gonna put across was, what are the most common challenges that you face from innovators or SMEs? Because I feel like innovators is a bit of a loaded term sometimes. Why don't we just talk about SMEs, and then we can go into that after the break. But what are some of the common problems that you feel like you get presented with from the SME side?
Okay. And should we get into that now, Steve? Do you want to go to the
break? Yeah, no, it's okay. We can run it through. Don't worry. It's all good. Okay. Don't worry. We'll go for a break in a second.
But, well, when you talk about challenges, you talk about kind of, you know, what challenges me or what challenges do they bring?
Yeah, like what do they say to you? Because they come to you and we come to you, PocDoc comes to you, other people come to you, and they say, hey, I need help with, you know.
So, you know, the number one thing obviously is, I can't get a conversation or I can't get a decision. So, you know, I'm having a warm conversation, or I had a warm conversation. There's no fast yes, there's no fast no. I don't really know where I am. Or I'm knocking on the door and no one's answering. That's, you know, huge, huge. Because so some of the stuff is really basics.
Mm.
If you want to kind of go beyond that, a lot of it is about, I don't know why my value proposition is not landing, because it makes perfect sense to me. How on earth could a team of really smart execs and clinicians look at this and not snap my hand off, but they're not doing that? What's happening here?
Right. And how do you deal with that last one? Because I think I'm glad you said that, because I think, you know, with the people that I talk to, and, you know, I know this, I do the Last Friday Club and try and help where I can and do these things. I hear that one the most.
Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, and I used to be property and chief exec of a HSN. I was the commercial director. So this was my world, you know, having these conversations. And I used to describe it as, you know, and I don't know if this is a bit of an insult to the NHS, but kind of like, I'm sitting on the illogical side of the table, but knowingly so. And the reason is because everyone actually does get it. I don't think there's a value proposition that doesn't stack up to people. As I said, people are really smart. They kind of get it. It's about why can't it happen?
Yes.
And it's also about the fact that innovators, quite rightly, in my view, are absolutely 100% focused on their particular innovation. It is always the silver bullet. It is always the thing that's going to be, you guys need to talk about this first. It's the priority for you. And that's obviously comes from a place of passion, but it also comes from a place of, wanting to have that kind of market share, wanting to really get into it in a big way. So I think you need to think about that in terms of that's not the same for the NHS. The NHS has a different set of priorities. The NHS is saying, we get it. However, what you can't see is this, there's an in-tray a mile long and the in-tray is on fire. So whereas I'm really excited about this, this isn't putting out this fire and it's not getting down the in tray. So if we ever get to the bottom of this, we might give you a conversation.
I think
If,
the other.
however, you can describe yourself as the fire extinguisher, then we might want to have a talk.
One of the stories I like to tell about PocDoc that ties into this is, and then I know my producer's waving at me madly to go for a commercial break, so apologies about that, Johan, but just let me spin my yarn. And then we when we first started the company and we got the tech, we knew what the technology could do, and we were going out talking to people. When we within our patient groups, and we spoke to a lot of patients, I mean hundreds of hours, almost exclusively everyone said, oh my goodness, this would be so much easier if I could just go to my GP and they did this instead of doing a lab test, and then I have to go back for the results, and then I have to come back again to go, this could I could do it in 5 minutes. That'd be incredible. I would love that. And we thought, oh, well, that's a great opportunity with GPs. GPs are going to really like that. They're going to be really keen on that. And so then we sort of shuffle off to go and speak to some GPs. And they're like, nah, we're not interested. But we couldn't quite get under the skin of why. And it was only when we started to talk to some of the health innovation networks, particularly Northwest Coast, and in a guy called Indy Singh up there, who's an absolute legend. Shout out Indy. And Mike Kenny and Phil Jennings, that we uncovered that GPs get lab testing for free, in effect. So why would they pay for a way to do a blood test of any kind when they get lab testing for free? And we were like, oh yeah, there's no business model there, is there? That doesn't make any sense. So then we went off to figure out where the per who the people had the fire. And where that was. So that we went through that process. So I totally empathize. Right. So we will go for our first commercial break now. And we will be back after that with my guest today, Richard Stubbs, who's the CEO of the Health Innovation Network, York and Humber, and chair of the National Health Innovation Network. We will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of today's show With my guest, Richard Stubbs, CEO of the health innovation York & Humber. So Richard, that was a great introduction into the whole area of NHS innovation and why it matters and why it should be something that matters to everybody listening, because we can't keep doing the same things. There's lots of amazing innovation in the system of all kinds. And one of the big bets, I guess, here is that we do more of it more efficiently, right? Is that sort of, I know that you aren't an author of the plan, but I assume in your role, you've had an opportunity to pass your feedback on. And so how important is innovation to the next 10 years of the NHS, in your opinion?
Yeah, so in my opinion, I would say this, wouldn't I?
But yeah, of course, opinion, but I mean, you're a bit biased, but...
Yeah, I am biased, but I genuinely hope that, you know, even if I wasn't doing this job, I'd have the same answer, which is I think is absolutely essential. You think about, you know, I don't know what the 10-year plan is going to say. You're right, you know, we've had a great opportunity to input. I did hear, and this is an exclusive, because I shouldn't have heard this yesterday, but they're on version 11.5, or, you know, so we'll find out what the final version is when it comes out, I guess. But whatever it says, we know that innovation is going to be threaded all the way through it. And I think that's pretty obvious, because we're not going to get ourselves out of the current challenge we're in by growing an extra 400,000, 500,000 workforce and being able to afford them in the next, you know, 2 to 3 years. It doesn't work like that. You know, we're not suddenly going to be able to build 50 or 60 new hospitals. You know, we've got to think about a different model of care, and that's the opportunity that innovation provides. And if you think about the three shifts, you know, so sickness to prevention, analog to digital, hospital to home, I don't know how you deliver any of those three. I mean, I think, you know, everyone points to analog to digital as the tech shift, but actually
I think it depends everything.
Exactly. The tech, how can you do this without innovation? How can you shift from hospital to home without innovation? So it has to be threaded through. I think it's a massive, massive opportunity for the NHS. You know, I think one of the things we saw during the COVID times was, you know, quite unfortunately, you know, the immediacy of the and the urgency of the challenge meant that people were prepared to do things differently.
Yeah.
I think there's something now about that. Yeah. It's not quite as in your face acute, is it, as COVID was. And that might be one of the problems. At the moment, NHS sustainability feels more like a climate change issue, as in we all know it's a problem. We all know we have to do something today to fix tomorrow. But actually, we all then get a little bit busy doing today and nobody actually looks at tomorrow. I think we've got to find a way of, you know, in the same way that climate change activists find a way to say, we need your attention now. We need to start doing things differently now. Mm. I think that's kind of where the NHS is at now. We need to start saying, actually, we need to start doing different things now. Otherwise, we don't have tomorrow.
I completely agree. And I think that there are enough voices saying that, you know, I just hope that we can somehow pull together as well around whatever this thing says, assuming it's not completely insane, but, you know, assuming it's sort of like sensible and ambitious, that we all just try and pull together to crack on, as opposed to sort of continuously forcing ourselves to justify why we're doing something. It's like, because then that just sucks up extra time. Yeah. I don't mean me, I mean sort of senior people in the system that need to be really focusing on doing what they think they should be doing, not continuously justifying why they're doing that thing in the first place.
Yeah, and I think what you'll find is that, you know, from what I hear, you know, again, you know, I haven't seen it. I got within 3 feet of it at Confest.
Before you were tackled to the ground.
I was told he was in a bag next to my feet, but that's the closest I got to the draft. I think what we'll find is you'll talk a lot about the next 3 years. Obviously, the NHS works a lot on election cycles, so inevitably there's something about the 3 years. But also, there's something as well. You know, even without an election cycle, there's stuff that needs to be tackled now. I think the 7 years beyond that, I think you'll talk in more vision terms about that.
Yeah.
But actually, what I think the trick is to make sure that we don't start tackling that kind of 3-year horizon challenge in the way we've always done things, and think that innovation is then to be saved for that kind of blue skies vision. Wouldn't it be great if, you know, we've got to say, great, you know, there's a 3-year fairly operational challenge in front of us. And I think that'll get really, really laid out in terms of what the priorities are. You know, the priorities will be the elective backlog, it'll be cancer, it'll be urgent emergency care. But we've got to tackle them differently. We don't just sweat the assets as we have done in previous decades to get waiting lists down.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I want to pick up on something you said earlier on in the show, around, I think you said something sort of like the NHS is slow at adopting innovation at scale or something like that. That statement sort of implies a comparison, if you like. So what are we comparing the NHS to, and what do we hope it could be? I mean, I say this because obviously I've been around the world in various different ways talking about what we do, and had lots of different people from different parts of the world who've had lots of different experience on the show. And it doesn't appear to me on the first face of it that compared to some other systems in other countries that we are demonstrably slower. So how do you kind of think about this thing? I know people, we all think it's slow, and I'm an innovator, I'd love it to be faster, and there's waiting lists and it's difficult to get a GP appointment. I'm not denying any of that, but I don't know if it's much better anywhere else.
It's a
Doesn't mean
really
we
good
shouldn't improve.
and it's a really, really good challenge, Steve. And I'm the same as you. You know, you think, well, point me to the benchmark, point me to the exemplar, and we'll go off and learn about that. I mean, I think there are, as always, I don't think there isn't a single country that says, we've got this. You know, come
No.
and look at how we do it. I think there are probably pockets of good practice elsewhere. There are particularly, I think, in terms of alignment of payments and incentives with the behavior you want to see, with the procurement you want to see. I think, you know, there's areas there that you could point to. I think there's areas in other countries where you'd point to more of I suppose, the social capital, social responsibility models where you think, well, actually, that's how you keep the prevention agenda alive. That's how you can invest in that. So this is probably a buffet, isn't it? It's not, we're not about to say this is a restaurant we're going to go and eat at. We're going to say this is the buffet. Let's take our pick. But I think in terms of the slow and low accusation, I think it's an accusation that we largely level at ourselves to say, even without an international benchmark, we should be better at this. Even without an international benchmark, there should be less friction in the system, and we shouldn't perhaps have the duplication of effort that seemingly there for us to get to the outcomes that we want to get to.
And I think that there is a lack of, and people sometimes, as you know, people sometimes give me a hard time about saying stuff like this. But I feel like we should, or the system should give itself some credit for setting those targets. Like, it doesn't have to do that. It doesn't have to have health innovation networks that try and help. You know, most healthcare systems that I've seen don't have that. It doesn't exist. Like, there's no one in Germany trying to help you work with the insurers, you know, similarly. So I don't know. I just feel sometimes there's a, I don't know. I don't know whether it's like an expectation or whether it's, I don't know, sort of not lack of gratitude or anything like that, but it's more just being aware and being thankful for what does exist.
Yeah, I think you're right. And maybe it's a British thing, isn't it? That we all kind of look at ourselves and say, oh, you know, if only if. And I think about, you know, I've had a background in, you know, I've done quite a lot of international health stuff in my NHS career, which has been a real privilege. The amount of contacts who come to me now, you know, even as recently as last week, from different countries saying, how can you help us to form something that looks like you guys? Or, you know, we think we're doing something that's similar, let's talk about how we can partner. So I think it's a model that has huge international interest, and like you say, hasn't really been achieved in many places.
No, and I,
Maybe we should be just that, you know, I talk about banging the drum all the time. Maybe we should be banging the drum more about this as a UK asset and actually
I think that there's
flying
an
flag.
element of, I think there's an element of exporting it. You know, I think that you wouldn't find many people in the innovation community in other countries saying, "Oh, I don't want people to help me." You know, I don't know quite how the funding model works and things like that, but I think it's a really good structure. So, the where I wanted, you sort of just hinted at it there, but what was your journey into this whole area like? You know, because you've been in the NHS ecosystem for a while now, but was that always the vision, or what, where did that kind of come from?
No, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I've been in the NHS now for 23 years, which hurts a bit saying it out loud. And before that, I was at the BBC. So I did the BBC for 4 or 5 years, straight out of university. That was a great blast. And actually, I found it incredibly useful. And there's probably a completely different podcast where Richard tells you all the similarities between the NHS and the BBC, of which there are a lot.
Both quasi-government funded, right?
Yeah, very much loved funding models constantly in question, political football. If you equate consultants in medical consultants with celebrities, then you kind of get an idea of the soft power and that, you know, influencing the outcome. There's a whole range.
Do they? Do they? Do you in the NHS? Do you call them the talent? Like you call them in the?
Yeah, yeah. Well, when I came in, I mean, having been a researcher in television, where I had no power whatsoever, and you had to influence all these really important, crucial parts of the workforce to do the things that you needed them to do. I kind of came in on the graduate scheme, and kind of went, "Oh yeah, this is the same job. They've just got stethoscopes and scalpels." But actually, right. You know, so. But I came in on the graduate scheme, which was an amazing experience, actually. But for me, I suppose what informed my journey was, you know, you finish the grad scheme. So I'm not a clinician, I'm a general manager. And you kind of go into these operational jobs in hospitals, which a lot of my friends and colleagues who kind of joined at the same time as me are still in those kind of operational jobs. They absolutely love them.
Okay.
It just wasn't for me. And the reason was because it just felt like we were just solving yesterday's problem again and again and again. Right. You know, and you know, I'm probably being incredibly unfair to what the job's really like, but that's how it felt when I was doing it. That kind of whole general management of, you know, you're running orthopedics or you're running urology or whatever. And it's just, I think for people who like just fixing stuff, that's kind of good. You can get, you know, go home thinking I've really, you know, delivered today. I was just constantly always wanting to go upstream and say, why does this problem exist? That's kind of my way of doing it. Kind of not just fix it wholesale. And so that kind of led me to, on a very convoluted route, into various things. But for me, about 13 years ago, so about 10 years after going to NHS, that's when I fell into more national jobs around innovation. And this wasn't some kind of back of an envelope career path about, you know, I'm going to do this, then this, then this. This was about saying yes, because, you know, I've always been on fixed term contracts and the contract was ending. So somebody said, do you want to come and do this? I was like, yes, I do want to come and do this. of course I do, you know. For the last 10 seconds, it's been the only job I've ever wanted to do my entire life. But you kind of just leapt from life raft to life raft. And then you just, you know, I just fell into this thing where I got into something called, you know, I was asked to do the Innovation Challenge Prizes, which was kind of a forerunner of the Innovate Awards that I've created. Okay. And then I got asked to, another Aradazi idea, actually. I got asked to create and lead something called NHS Global. Now, NHS Global.
Well, that sounds snazzy.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it was... especially for something kind of, you know, effectively run out of my bedroom. But it was NHS Global was the NHS's first attempt to think about how it could leverage its IP and soft diplomatic power and really help that kind of bilateral conversation with different governments. So it was about, you know, what do we have to offer? What do we have to learn? So a global reach, spent many years doing that, going to all sorts of weird and wonderful places around the world, you know, huge pleasures to do it. Effectively, you know, in the time of austerity, because this is when it was created, how could it help UK PLC by sweating the assets of our public sector investment more? Mm. Spent a long time in Libya, Tripoli, Benghazi.
Oh, wow. What the heck? What was that like?
Well, it was very security conscious, as you can imagine. I led the first UK mission into Libya after Gaddafi had been killed. And so we were there 6 weeks later. Prime Minister Cameron had promised to rebuild Misrata Hospital. So we led a delegation there. Again, there's another story for another time. But
that's incredible.
There's a hero story about Libya.
6 weeks doesn't seem like a long time.
It wasn't a very long time, no. And, you know, myself or, you know, some DH colleagues at the time, and then bodies like Arup and others, you know, the kind of big kind of infrastructure UK excellence going in there to say, effectively, you know, this is a regime change environment, and how can the UK now come and help? You know, there was an emerging national government that we met. Obviously, that kind of fell apart 2 years later. So we spent a few missions into Libya, but that fell apart. But yeah,
what was that like? What did you expect it to be, and what was it like when you got there?
It was still very militia controlled. So I remember landing at the airport in Tripoli, and we just basically took our bags off the plane ourselves and walked across the runway. And there were all these guys with machine guns just waving us, hilariously still waving us through a metal detector. and the morning we landed, there'd been a firefight. Two militia had a firefight on the runway. And I was in Cairo, and I'd gone to the air desk to say, this has apparently happened. What are we going to do about it? And they said, oh, we'll just send the first flight in and see what happens. And of course, we were the first flight. So it was like, oh, thanks for that. But that was a fascinating time. You know, massive, massive, massive respect to our diplomatic service who lived in Cricket. You know, I was there for, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks. They were there for, you know.
You were there for 3 or 4 weeks?
In two different stints.
In two different stints?
Yeah. So 3 or 4 weeks in total. But they were, you know, they had 6 month postings out there. That was their life. They lived in a compound The Benghazi compound was effectively a, you know, felt more like an underground bunker. And that was where they did their business on behalf of, on behalf of the UK, you know, and they did it with a smile on their face and that usual kind of British stoic resolve and sense of humor. And it's like, this is just incredible.
That's incredible.
So hugely in awe of what they do. And the fact that nobody in Britain knew about the work they were doing effectively, you know, in terms of the detail. No. This is what daily life looks like, just going to the office.
Yeah.
I think we need to make that more transparent, because that was just incredible.
That's
but
amazing.
I've been NHS Global for a while, and then I went to NHS England, and that's when we really started to create things like the HSNs at the time. And I just thought, actually, a national job is great. I love doing a national job, but it did feel one removed, particularly thinking from where I'd kind of started, you know, in that kind of hospital job, it felt a little bit too distant. And the HSNs at the time, that just felt like a real roll your sleeves up and do something kind of job. So I'm lucky enough to actually become the commercial director at Yorkshire, as I said.
Yeah.
And that's what got me into here. So, and then I think I, you know, accidentally had stumbled across my dream job, because I think my skill set, you know, is networking, contacting. I call myself knitter in chief for the region. That seems to be the job. You know, how do you just, you see all these different threads and you just think, how do you join all this up? Because everyone's trying to have the same conversation, but they just keep missing each other. You know, whether it's our innovator sector and our NHS, but also our mayors and local authorities. And it's just, we all want the same thing for our place.
Yeah.
It just seemed to be just bouncing off each other.
I think what I'd like to pick up on, because we have to go for our final commercial break now, is that translation element and why that's so important. Because I think that's a little bit like something that gets missed in the shuffle. And because innovation is often thought of as like, I make a new thing and then someone uses that thing. And I think there's this big bit in the middle where actually how you do the translation between what the thing does and putting the fire out, to use your previous analogy, really makes the difference, or can make the difference between success or failure. And that's where I feel like that's where the health innovation networks have really begun to accelerate their value. So we will be right back with the final part of this week's show with my guest today, Richard Stubbs, CEO of the Health Innovation Network, York and Humber. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Is this the year you're going to sort out your health goals? Never heard of frequency medicine, but willing to give it a try? Curious to discover there is a way to click your way to optimal health? At BioHealthScan, we found a way for you to recover your lost good health faster than conventional methods, in a safe and pain-free way. Join in with the rest of us and try our 21-day challenge for optimal health. Do it yourself. Save ourselves today. Find your way to biohealth-scan.com/21-day-challenge. Or, for a whopping 20% discount, click on the BioHealth Scan 21-Day Challenge DIY SOS banner on the UK Health Radio homepage now. BioHealth Scan, paving the way to manage your health a better way.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, the amazing Richard Stubbs, CEO of York and Humber Health Innovation Network and the chair of the National Health Innovation Network. And we know now, because we've all been listening to the show, that the Health Innovation Networks effectively are this a layer, if you like, that champion innovation inside the system and help innovators and SMEs who are outside the NHS system learn and develop solutions that can be adopted in the NHS system to solve. Is that a fair summary, Richard? Is that I just sort of put that one together. Is that fair?
I think that's very good.
Thank you very much. I didn't even look at my notes then, actually. So one of the things that I think gets lost in the shuffle here a little bit is, and you mentioned it before the break, is this element of translation. And I think it's really, it's soft and it's hard to get your head around and it's hard to actually sort of like objectify it. But I think it's one of the most critical things that determines the success of innovation in the NHS from what I've managed to observe. I'm not talking about PocDoc, I'm talking generally. So across the last couple of years of doing this show and doing the last Friday Club, I spoke to 300 or 400 different entrepreneurs, and the ones that have succeeded the most are the ones that can very clearly map what their innovation does onto a very clear need in the system.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I think we underestimate how important that is. And, you know, the NHS is a very pressurized, busy place. You know, if you're going to make that elevator pitch, you've got to think about that first 10 seconds. It's got to be about the problem that the person in front of you has got, not the tech. I think one of the things that I think is to my advantage is, you know, I'm not a tech person. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a clinician. I'm kind of sat in a real basic level of, is the thing you're talking to me about going to be of interest to the person I want to go and talk to about it? Mm. And that's kind of where I stay. So sometimes innovators will talk to me, you know, with huge passion and love about, you know, the data or, I don't know, you know, what amazing tech they've got in this particular smartphone app that they developed. It's all great stuff. Mm. And, you know, I'm usually kind of hanging on to the coattails of some really clever people trying to follow the science. But really what my brain is saying is, how do I take this conversation to somebody in my patch,
yeah,
and say it in a way that is relevant to them? And, which probably 90% of what's been told me is not going to make that conversation.
And also that person may be, for example, a really senior consultant that's just coming out of surgery or just going into surgery, or, you know, that or is running a ward or is doing all kinds of really,
or a director of really finance who's just been told he's got to cut his running costs by 50%, and, you know,
right.
So what, you know, there's different ways into this, but usually, almost certainly, particularly that first kind of conversation, almost certainly none of it is about the tech.
Right.
That comes later. You know, the NHS is an incredibly evidence based place. Mm. You know, you're going to have to earn the trust of some, you know, sometimes slightly risk averse for good reason people to say this thing is better than the practice you're doing now. But for that initial conversation, it's got to be about this thing sorts your problems out in the following way. And that particular problem it's sorting out is the problem that's most important to you right now.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so, like, how receptive and open do you feel like the innovators and founders are to receiving back the reality of that message sometimes? And what responsibility do you think the SME community has to sort of take that feedback and work on it, as opposed to sort of, I don't know, telling you you're wrong? I don't know.
Well, I mean, obviously quite a liberty to do that. I'm wrong about most things, but I think
I didn't mean you specifically.
But I think they're wrong. You know, they're not going to get very far in the NHS. Would be my kind of pushback to them. I think there is a responsibility. I mean, I completely get why this happened. You know, if I'd have spent 3, 4, 9, or 10 sometimes years of my life on something that I was incredibly passionate about, that I genuinely believed is at the heart of, you know, really transforming patients' lives. And I'd done some amazing things on the tech, whatever that may be, to make something happen that perhaps nobody's made happen before.
Mm.
You gotta, you know, we all want to be able to tell that story. We all want to say, look, this is my victory. Let me tell you about the thing you're holding in your hand, you know.
Yep.
And so the appetite for doing that is obvious. And as I said, there is a time for that conversation, but it's probably not the first conversation. So
right.
It is about understanding that the people that we're trying to pitch to have no real interest in where it's come from. They just want to know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And
I think that's really insightful.
It needs to be in a language that they understand, and it needs to be on the agenda that they understand. If you look at things like ambient voice technology, you know, at the moment, ambient voice technology.
Which, by the way, let's just explain to everyone what that is.
Yeah.
Before. Yeah, go on.
Ambient voice technology, you know, using AI tools to listen in on, let's say, a patient-clinician conversation that's happening in clinic, and using the information that it hears in the English language to be able to then populate various bits of administrative requirements, such as the patient record, such as diagnostic tests that need to be ordered, and such as the patient letter, the GP letter to be sent out. It does it in a way that means the clinician has to review a draft rather than compose a letter from scratch. And the productivity, you know, the time saved is literally amazing. And I think we're only in the foothills of that. But because there's a direct benefit to that particular clinician, you know, the pitch that for me, the pitch is this tech gives you more face-to-face time with your patients.
Mm-hmm.
What a great pitch. You can see it, and it's written in, it's phrased in a way that means I'm solving your problem.
Yeah.
And you could talk about why it's great. You could talk about how amazing the technology is, but no one cares. They just
the truth, exactly. They don't care about how it works. They just care that it does work and the impact that it has. Yeah. And actually, on the thing with ambient scribes, is what's really interesting, as far as I know, is like a lot of the GPs and clinicians basically just started using them.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh my gosh, this is absolutely incredible. I've just saved all of this time. It was sort of a really good example of how that type of innovation can spread like wildfire.
And we need to look into this, because I asked the question, that exact question, to somebody very senior interesting yesterday about, you know, why, how do we almost like leverage this new culture of adopting AI tools in a very organic way.
Yeah.
And, you know, the answer back was, you know, this is working because it's easy to use and people see a direct benefit back to themselves and their workflow.
Yeah.
In the same way that we would, you know, any human being would say, can I install it easily? Is it going to help me in a way that I feel?
You know? Do you know what's interesting? We could do a whole nother show on this, I know, but I think it would be because if what you're saying an ambient scribe does, which is true, which is effectively digitize another form of dialogue or interaction, right, in real time to make it easier and save time. Well, we've heard, I'm sure you've heard, I've certainly heard stories from innovators that do digitize physical interactions, you know, paper forms to digital forms, and, mm-hmm. you know, or automation of intake forms and registration and all this other stuff. And it didn't happen there. I'd just be kind of interested to understand that, you know, like what are the differences and how to map them to see if we can learn something.
Yeah. And that exactly right. And I was kind of going there in this meeting was like yesterday with my thinking, because my sense is that even though all those examples you mentioned are obviously fantastic, they obviously have huge productivity savings, is the pain point felt as directly to the individual or not? Or is it just a sense of yeah, I get that, that's good,
yeah,
but actually the difference for me is minimal or not enough for me to go through the pain barrier?
Well, so I saw something with Elon Musk years ago before he went off on whatever tangent he's on at the moment, but it was which we won't go into, but it was about Tesla, and he was like, look, if you're gonna, it's fine to launch a business in an existing category. A lot of innovators or startup people get obsessed about having to quote unquote be the first in their category, the first thing. And he's like, no, it's completely fine. But if you launch into an existing category, your thing has to be so much better than the leader in that, because otherwise you're going to lose immediately. And I wonder whether these ambient scribes are just so much better. Yeah. Just, it's just a gulf of experience. Whereas filling in a form on a computer is sort of a bit better and a bit easier than writing it down, but it doesn't necessarily, it's not actually felt as keenly maybe.
No, but you're absolutely right. There's learning to be had from looking more deeply into this and looking into, you know, what has been unlocked and again, it reminds me a little bit of the pandemic. You know, when the pandemic happened, obviously it was a very interesting time for Health Innovation Networks because, you know, we had a question to ask, you know, what's our role in this?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of our staff are clinicians. So the first job was everyone get back to work. You know, that was obvious. But after a while, I think we, certainly in Yorkshire Humber, what I thought was we need to do some research into how we are seeing or what are the conditions that are allowing staff to somehow be a little bit risk-taking when it comes to changing the ways that they practice and the speed of iteration that that's happening at. Because although obviously some of those conditions were obviously going to be COVID-centric, you know, a check from the Treasury, there's a singular challenge that every bit of the cog, you know, the cogs are all pointed at one challenge. Some of the stuff might be replicable in kind of non-COVID times. And, you know, what the research showed was that some of the stuff that really facilitated this was about huge empowerment on the front line, visibility of leadership, and I suppose permission to act. And those are the kind of things that you can then think, well, that's kind of what we need to think about in terms of the now.
Yeah.
And maybe there's some of that wrapped up with ambient scribes and voice tech to say, actually, it's just easier for a clinician to make a decision on this than it would be on something that's a little bit more
so, of a complex pathway. But to the point, so I think ambient scribes, without wishing to go on about it, and if you want to Google it, by the way, there's a ton of stuff that's happening in the NHS about ambient scribes. It's like a kind of a big deal right now, isn't it? It's kind of a big thing. So go have a look. We've only got a few minutes left, but to the point I made earlier in the show about who are we comparing ourselves to, I was at the health conference last week, as were you, in Amsterdam, which is a wonderful event, and I got chatting to the EU Commissioner for Digital Health, just randomly, as one does, and the issue of ambient scribes came up, and I was stood with somebody who was running an ambient scribe company, and we were talking about how it was basically exploding, in a good way, in the NHS, and it was fantastic, and clinicians actually were the people that are adopting it fastest. It wasn't actually having to be coming down from the centre. And she was completely shocked. She was absolutely gobsmacked because in Spain and in France and in all these other places, this is what she said, there's a huge backlash from doctors about it. Huge. Mm. They don't want it. They think it's taking their jobs away. They want to stay where it is. And it's like, it made me realize that it's not all bad in the NHS. You know?
No.
I don't know.
It's really interesting. I mean, today I'm at BMA House, so in London, and I was at a Health Foundation event this morning where I was basically asked on a panel to talk about what the future holds and what the big challenges are for the NHS. And one of the things I talked about was we're going to have to get real about trust in tech, and tech in its broadest sense, but AI in particular. And I think, you know, that's a whole different conversation, but there's something for me about ambient technology showing the way that it's possible. But actually, there's so many other use cases for AI and other bits of tech where we haven't yet got the workforce behind it. We haven't got the patients behind it. We haven't got the citizens behind it. And I think if we're really going to get the benefits of the innovation that's in our pipeline, we're going to have to think about that conversation.
I completely agree. We've got 1 minute left, 1 minute on the nose. So in the very end of every show, I just ask my guests to say, what's the kind of motto or mantra that you've used or relied on in your life to get through difficult times that you want to pass on to the people listening? It can be anything, you know, but you've probably got about 45 seconds now, so no pressure.
No pressure at all, and no warning either.
Yeah.
I think it is probably something along the lines of this too shall pass. Right. You know, I think there is something about the fact that when you're in the moment, and I've been in many, many moments in my career and personal life, and it kind of always feels weightier than it is with some distance. And I think there is something about telling yourself over and over again that although it feels like the entire world has folded in on you, this too shall pass.
And perfect.
At the Richard, moment, that's what it always has done.
You've hit it. We're good. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week.